address such comments. Wow, here we are in the Backpack Show. I'm Chris Brogan. This is Seance host Carrie Gorgon.
Are you there? Can you hear us?
What the heck? You know, you get what you get when you're traveling, right? That's what you get. So Carrie's actually back at the TSA right now. They have her in a room where they're discussing whether or not what kind of probes have to happen.
They said I had done some questionable broadcasts and,
in the past.
Fit to travel, yeah.
So, you know, it's what we get when we interview people like poop doctors. The founder of evolutionary medicine early in the week and now evolutionary biology. We're evolving.
We have three today, by the way.
We have three guests. That's crazy town. Carrie, who did we bring on today?
Well, this would be easier if you explained it, but...
Oh, I'll do it. I got you.
Harvard professor Daniel Lieberman, who I came across his book about exercise and how, from an evolutionary standpoint, we just basically how our habits today don't align necessarily with how we evolved, but why exercise is good for us anyway, and we need to do it, like make ourselves do things that feel artificial to us. Terry Painter, an expert in commercial real estate. He wrote the Encyclopedia of Commercial Real Estate. And go ahead.
Well, you know, I'll fill in. I'll pretend to be Carrie. And we have Alila Longmire from Ascot Manor, who has a brand around tennis. So we're going to learn about, you know, clothing and the like. And by the way, $10 off any order of $100 or more. So,
Oh, I love it. But they also help new tennis players, right?
On the yes. Way yep. Nothing
so that's
can stop
me. I was very excited to talk to Alila about was that aspect of
right.
her business.
To get us out of the habit of trying to baseball bat the tennis ball away, we get to learn, you know, when we put on our ascots, what we should then do with the racket. I think it's going to be an opportunity.
I haven't seen an ascot since Scooby.
Well, I'm wearing one right now, but we shouldn't.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Carrie Gorgon, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
So glad to have everybody here. Do I really have an ascot on? No, I don't even.
I don't believe you.
Probably not. You folks need to stop interviewing authors. I'm going broke buying their books. My wife's going to kill me. Hey, Carol, how are you? Remember, we are also on Twitch, twitch.tv/TheBackpackShow. Dan Lieberman has a massive following on Twitch, so we need to have some people come over there and say hi to him from there. Big gamer when he's offline. Probably not, but that's, you know, I like to think that that's true. I'm going to break the record on actually remembering to do ads at the beginning of the show a couple times. Authors, if you don't want to make your own website to publish and promote your book, you could do it really fast and easy with PubSite. Pub-site.com takes you just a couple hours. You could have a whole website made and ready to go. Nothing fancy. You don't need to hire some web designer per se. Just hook this baby up and it's running. This is the same people that do Tom Clancy's website. I think Robin Cook, and I'm totally forgetting a third person who's probably also really important. Pub-site.com.
It's many well-known authors.
That's right. It's $19.99 a month. If you want them to make the site for you and you want them to hold your hand the whole way through, $4.99 US dollars, that's three quarters off what I would charge you. You want to make a show? Make a show just like this. You could be on the road somewhere and nobody would even know where to find the body, but you could start the show and run it. Seabrogan.me/StreamYard makes a show just like this.
You can actually run it from your phone if you have to.
If you have to,
would that suggest
totally
that it's
that.
Easy?
We are podcasting because as many times as I try to get out of the podcast game, they keep pulling me back in. We're podcasting because Castos.com makes for a great podcasting host. So easy, so lickety button pushy. Click, 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 and you're done. There's a podcast. So you got to do the recording, you got to do the editing, but oof, right up there it goes, castos.com. My buddy Matt works over there, Matt Medeiros. So totally unrelated to the earth is the fact that Johnsonville gives us sausage to give to you. So Johnsonville.com. We have one
limited amounts of sausage left. So
that's right.
At ChrisBrogan.com, and all you have to do is send us a video of you cooking, eating, and enjoying it.
Carrie's sausage closet is getting very empty, so make sure you make an order.
Sausage closet.
Carrie's sausage closet.
That must be tough if you're in commercial real estate and you're like, you know what I need? A sausage closet.
That's right. I mean, let's ask the question. Terry Painter, do you think that people have ever in the history of your business asked for a commercial sausage closet?
And we get about 3 or 4 requests for that a day, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's really important to be well stocked with sausage if you're going to be doing, you know, major financing.
I agree. You need to grease the wheels.
Yeah. Now, it's important that people realize that you wrote the encyclopedia on commercial real estate. You're also a mortgage banker, so you're helping on not just like, you know, I think you'd look lovely in this retail strip mall, but also here I would like to help you find the right way to finance this and all that. My feeling is that it maybe has been just a wee bit tricky, no matter what part of the real estate business you're in, over this last year or so. Can you tell a little bit about like what the landscape looked like from your side?
Well, certainly on the commercial real estate side, and we're talking about apartment buildings, strip malls, industrial buildings, self-storage facilities, and so on. What's happened is that we're in a recession. This is the coronavirus recession.
Right.
And as in all recessions, money tightens because lenders don't really know what the outcome is going to be. They don't really know where property values are going to settle and so on. So, but as everybody probably knows, hospitality, which is hotels and motels, and certainly strip malls, retail in general, and office buildings have been very challenged during this recession, just as they were in the last recession, the Great Recession.
So in that process, with recessions, there's always a chance that there's going to be a new way that people are going to want to spend their money. There are things that are changing in residential real estate because people are suddenly a lot more working from home. So for instance, places like San Francisco, where it's pretty expensive to live as a resident, there's been this massive change of people moving to places like Colorado. How does that impact commercial as well? What's like, for instance, restaurants are having a challenge. How does the recession whack the various places?
Well, restaurants for sure are being challenged, but more so, I mean, just equally so are office buildings. I have a client in downtown Los Angeles who says it's like a ghost town there. It's not just, it's a large building. It's probably a $40, $50 million building, okay? And what the problem is not just his tenants that cannot, you know, just do business as usual, but it's also all the ancillary businesses, the restaurants, the other shops downtown are being affected. So, and also I think that during the Great Recession, we saw the same thing. Office properties got hit really hard. However, it came back. During this recession, I really question whether it's gonna come back because more people are getting used to working at home and they like it.
That's a point. What about people who are thinking about getting into commercial real estate and have never considered it before, like as an investment, let's say? What do they need to know to avoid screwing up majorly?
Well, it's really real estate, investing in income producing real estate is pretty much the same, but you know, commercial real estate is a more sophisticated model of real estate investment. It's really it's really a business that has to be studied, and that's where my book comes in. Mainly because you have the income of the property and where the property is located, there's more learning curves than buying a rental home that you want to, you know, rent out in your own backyard.
With regards to that, your point, so this person who has an office space, so their office space, like you said, it's a ghost town. Like, it's going to be really hard to fill those spots. So it's hard for them to cover the nut, so to speak, and get the money handled just right. But like you said, the ancillary restaurants nearby are having trouble. Cobblers, nail places, any of the strange things that get, you know, aligned in the sort of village of business where people aren't going to those locations. Is there any safe place to put your money? If somebody came to you and said, Terry, I've got a bag of money, now what? What would you say?
Well, for sure, apartment buildings. That's our number one product. But right now, what's happening is that investors from the other commercial real estate food groups are flooding into apartments, which is raising the prices on those. And however, if you're going to invest in an apartment building, it's better if you can do it. It's better to do it in a safe, good neighborhood, you know, and not in a rough neighborhood where the prices are going to be lower, because working class neighborhoods right now, there's about 16 to 20% of the tenants that are not paying the rent. where, and so apartments have a risk too, but the best thing about commercial real estate, if you think about it, if you're going to have like four rental properties, why not have, instead of running all over town to maintain them, why not have them all under one roof? You know, and so it's just the economy of scale and it makes more sense. But apartments, boy, I mean, because they're so considered so safe right now compared to other forms of commercial real estate, that's the way to go.
Is there any kind of business that's like poison and you immediately say, absolutely not, don't invest in that real estate, like that type of business?
Well, yeah, I hate to say it, but gyms. And, you know, sorry to Dan Lieberman, but that's, he's on exercise, but, you know, gyms are just gyms. Okay, so I have two companies, Apartment Loan Store and Business Loan Store. So we used to do a lot of business loans, and gyms have always been challenging because they have a very low profit margin. So in fact, if everybody showed up who has a membership, they would really be in trouble. So, you know, for sure gyms, and of course, you know, so many major chains of restaurants, like even Applebee's, you know, have been really challenged. So, you know, having a restaurant as a tenant could be a problem for a while, but eventually those are going to come back.
It's amazing to just think through all the sure thing businesses that are not sure things any longer. But yeah, you know, with regards to apartments, for instance, yeah. There's a lot more people that are kind of, you know, well, I, for instance, so this, I live in a loft, which is a condo officially, and it's an owner type property where I have a mortgage and all that. But my next goal is I want to live in an apartment again. I want to live in a rent scenario. I think that owning real estate is great, but I think that also having a rental unit where, like, I'm not waiting around for equity. I can put those money in different places. So I think that there's a lot of things in the works because of this migration that's happening, where we don't have to be in the zip code of where these businesses are. That's going to push people a lot more towards your business. Are you positioning for that? Like in your plans for 2021 and beyond, how have you looked at that?
Well, you know, interesting that you asked that question because since the early 2000s, my business has been national. So we do loans in all 50 states. And what's really great is that, like right now, I'm at my winter home in the Dominican Republic, which is in the Caribbean. And I could work anywhere. And, you know, this is a good time zone because my business is in America. So we're already set up for what you're talking about.
Cool. So is the way your business is set up that way. Are you advising, or I mean, with maybe through Business Loan Store and whatnot, are you advising people to prep for this kind of a future where there's going to be a lot fewer, zip code dependent kind of businesses? Or
I just think that's a really great question because I think that business in general, I mean, if you take a look at retail, and retail was already in trouble before the coronavirus recession hit because people were already migrating towards buying more online. And I think that we're going to see more businesses that can actually sell on the internet. And it's just so much more efficient. It's also a tremendous time saver just for your employees not to have to drive to the office, you know, and commute. You know, they could be more productive. They could have more time with their families. They're going to be happier. And this particular calamity that we're in with this pandemic is going to make some major changes on the way we do business.
I can see that as well.
Carrie, do you have... feature? Yeah, I want to know. So weirdest feature somebody has wanted in a commercial property besides the sausage closet, which I gather has become common.
What's the weirdest feature? She's asking, what's the weirdest thing someone asks for in a commercial property that you kind of...
Well, in the old days, I would say one of the most unusual things is plots in a graveyard. That's commercial real estate. Also, wow. I mean, going along with that is actually...
But those people never pay. Those people never pay.
Well, they're actually, you have to pay in advance for those.
Yes.
But also, certainly funeral homes is... It's something that our firm used to finance. We haven't had an order for one of those for a while, but yeah. But, you know, that's certainly, I shouldn't even bring that up. I was going to say it's a going business, but I guess you could say anything on your show, so.
Love it. Yes, you really can. Terry Painter, thanks so much. Stick around if you can. We do a little panel somewhere near the end. Stick around if you can. If you can't, we get it. I'm going to throw you backstage. Boop. just like that. And we're going right to Alila Longmire because, you know, when you think commercial real estate, the next thing you think is tennis. Hey, Alila.
Hi.
So there's absolutely no transition there whatsoever. But, you know, you run a brand called Ascot Manor. So first off, when I immediately hear the name Ascot, I only immediately think of like fancy people, which of course is kind of the look and feel of the brand. Right. Talk a little bit about picking this brand up, putting it together. What made you say, no, this is what I want to represent here?
Ooh, well, I mean, it took a couple of years before I really kind of moved forward with it. Essentially, I've owned a PR agency for some 12 years, but I've been playing tennis for maybe about 10 now. And where I play tennis, I just started noticing the drop-off rate of like really highly skilled kids of color in tennis. A lot of times it was their grandmother taking them to practice, and you see them in programs, you see them get to a certain level, and then poof, they're gone. And this is up in Harlem in New York, which is quite diverse now in terms of you've got a lot of new luxury buildings, but you still have a lot of projects and all of that. So you're getting a mix of kids kind of coming in and out in all different scenarios. And you bond with these kids. You see them, you know, tennis, wherever you play, is always like a tight-knit community. And it just kind of, I just started asking questions between a lot of the coaches and what happened to this kid, what happened to that kid, and it was always the same issue, money, right? So it can cost a kid, a junior player, on a competitive level, you're talking $100,000, $120,000 a year. So you can imagine if it's a kid in a project, single mom, more than one kid, how do you even afford that, right? And so you have a lot of great programs, but you've got more kids than programs, and there's a lot of dynamics that go along with that. And it's been noted in the media, the lack of players of color and a lack of American players in tennis. So I just was ambitious enough to feel like I want to do something about this. And just from being on the PR marketing side, working with a lot of brands, working with a lot of professional athletes in the past, I just knew how sponsorship works in terms of companies giving to programs, but it's very hard to really focus on individuals. And so that's where the shift comes in with a brand like Ascot Manor. We are working directly with the kids who need it, who need the help the most. So
how long does it take to bring a player that you see has talent to bring them to the level where they can compete?
So usually they're already competing. It's that they can't keep up with the cost to continue. So a good scenario, you know, prior to COVID happening, you know, a top junior player is doing X amount of national tournaments a month and then has to also do international tournaments as well to keep gathering those points. So you can imagine a lot of these kids are homeschooled as well too. So they're already up there. It really comes down to, can I keep up with all of these tournaments if I don't have the money to do so, you know, and who's going to help me at that point?
So how do you match sponsors with players? Like, what's that kind of matchmaking process to find the right fit?
So a couple ways. I mean, definitely through coaches. You know, we'll get referrals from coaches that say this kid really, you know, needs help. Brand awareness as well. You know, we get a lot of kids actually internationally that'll just apply and say, I really need the help. And then we go through like a vet process there. And then, you know, just again, our connections, resources, and partnerships with coaches at the USTA will really kind of give us the evaluation. Okay, this kid really has potential. This is someone that can really use the help.
So the Ascot Manor, I'm way stuck on the fancy pantsness of the name. Like, you know, because when you say Harlem tennis people coming up, none of them knows an Ascot is. Like, what made you pick that? What makes you set
that's
that
the
brand
idea
up?
Because tennis will always be an elite sport. We don't want to take away from that.
Right.
And I myself, I grew up in Los Angeles and the suburbs, so I like to keep a little bougie-ness involved at all times, but we got a lot of grit to the, you know, to the company. It's really too about exposing an elite sport to everyone, to people too, that otherwise, like you said, not even know what Ascot is, the Royal Ascot or any of that. You know, I wanted to show people what that could look like everywhere, which is the power of the internet and having an e-com site like Ascot.
It's a it's an interesting brand to look through too. Like as I'm looking through your Instagram, there's this long
top 100 national top 100 kid from Harlem.
Wild. But yeah. but like right there speaks to this conversation that's going on in tennis all the time. I'm friendly with Alexis Ohanian, who's married to someone people know in tennis, that Williams girl, Serena, something.
The greatest.
and people are always talking about, you know, like the racism that's involved with when they complain about when she's angry or you know, when she brings her energy to it. There's a lot of race conversation in tennis, but there's also that sense, to your point, of it's a bougie kind of sport, and there's a lot of people who are trying to make it feel a little less. But that's not, I'm curious to know your take on that. Like, what's Ascot Manor contributing to that, and what do you want people to take and feel from that?
I mean, the whole point, I mean, I feel like the goal with Ascot too is to make it a community thing. Like, people who love tennis really do stick together, right? And so essentially, by reinvesting a portion of ourselves back into the business, gets other people involved with that. So, you know, but we're not changing those dynamics of that being an elite sport. We're just opening up to other people who necessarily don't have access to it, and just making it a little bit, I don't want to say cooler, because for me, it's as cool as you can go, but just making it more accessible and maybe taking a little bit of the intimidation out of it, so to speak.
Is this girl wearing Ascot Manor, or are both people wearing Ascot Manor? Because is that guy wearing a flannel shirt on the tennis court?
Yeah, that's the photographer.
Oh, okay, okay.
What do you think he's doing? What, like, tennis play is that?
I'm like, I've never seen a lumberjack tennis player, and I'm thinking maybe Alila knows something whole new level that I don't know.
No. It should. Maybe next time I'll make sure all my photographers are wearing Ascot, too.
Do your players must, right? Your players that are sponsored must go out wearing the brand.
We're going, yes. And the idea is to, you know, have on-court, off-court essentials to where you're just kind of always repping tennis. And I kind of like how, like, Roger Federer has such great style on and off the court. We wanted to just not only have the tennis apparel, but then you kind of have that swag off the court, too. That transitions well, you know, it's a whole vibe.
Then do the players give you feedback that goes into like your product research and development?
Absolutely. That's key. Performance is key. It has to not only look good, but they've got to be able to really play in it. You know, they're sweating like crazy, and then they're going through clothing quickly. So all of that's important and will always continue to be important in like how we improve and grow and all of that in apparel.
I'm just looking and I'm thinking, like, you know, I don't have to even swing a racket. I could look pretty sporty if I just put that on.
Exactly. That's the idea, which is this jacket I have on, actually.
That's what I thought. When I looked at it, I was like, oh, nice. I wonder if we're wearing the merch here. But that's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I definitely would not sell anything I wouldn't wear myself, actually. So.
So how do the sponsorships work? Is it sponsorships that you create relationships and then also you have a portion of your proceeds that goes to that? Or, like, how does it all work?
Right. So essentially, we have three levels of sponsorship. So the stripe in our in the A in our logo actually represents the three tiers of sponsorship. So the lowest is just being clothing. And then it kind of goes up to where we're able to start covering some fees, tournament fees, some travel, help with travel and things like that. Ace white being the highest is where we can fully offset costs for that whole year. So that would be the highest level of sponsorship. And it is relationship based. Obviously, these kids have to keep up their grades. They have to be playing well. You know, there is definitely a criteria for sponsorship. And it is, I mean, we're still very new. So a lot of it is dictated by ourselves because we're reinvesting the money back in to be able to do that. And that's why I was going back to saying I really wanted it to be almost like a community effort as well, too, so that, you know, people that follow the brand can kind of take these players with them, follow them, and grow with them as well, too.
I want, like, an evening gown. That blue one with the stripe, that's gorgeous. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It's one of my favorites. Yeah.
Tennis happens to be one of those sports you can engage in at 6 feet apart for the most part.
That's right. That's right.
So has that kept your sport rolling in this kind of climate?
As soon as they lifted the restrictions on tennis, ourselves just went right back to – normal. And then tennis is also something you can play into like your 70s, 80s. There's people that I watch that just keep going until you can't go anymore. It's just, it's a beautiful sport.
Love it.
Yeah. And I'm happy that some fans have been allowed back in the Australian Open. Hopefully at my Disneyland US Open, I'll be able to get a front row seat somewhere.
All by yourself. Nobody else in the row.
Nobody. Yeah, exactly.
I'm all here for this setup here with the little event you had and everything. That's pretty nice.
Oh, yeah.
Started with some cookies and stuff like that.
Oh, you're a sucker for a fanny pack, Chris.
I love a good fanny.
Oh, Leela Longmire. I feel like I'm missing one little deal, though. I feel like I'm missing. See, Scott tells me to close, make the man. Minter says we're not so far away from each other in his email. Oh, because Naz is over in Milan. If you're closer than 6 feet to your opponent in tennis, something is wrong, or you're John McEnroe.
That's funny. So,
still can't play in London, according to Minter Dial, author Minter Dial. So it's not worldwide just yet, but there's a lot to pick up. Leela Longmire, thanks for swinging by. Thanks for
thank you for having me.
Yeah, stick around. Like I said, we have a little bit of a panel near the end, but thank you so much for coming on. Boop.
Dave Davies likes my boops. Swing by.
Had to. I haven't made one.
Dave Davies likes your boops?
He likes my boops. Yeah, you heard it wrong. But that's okay because, you know, don't judge. But also, I think that I haven't made one lyric comment this entire interview. So, you know, I figured that's swinging waiting. By.
Let's see your beads. Can we see them?
Because they're making such a ruckus. I just turned my mic volume down. But these are my don't fidget Buddhist prayer beads. When I'm not on the show, I just use them to breathe. But when I'm on the show, I use them to try to not touch as many buttons. So
I usually have my capo and I'm like going back and forth with it. But I don't today.
Everyone loves the boops. What's not to like? So we're going to bring in Dan Lieberman because he's going to help us get better all the way around. Hello, Professor Lieberman. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
Best day of my life thus far. We brought you in because it's Carrie's fault. Why don't you tell?
But why do we hate to exercise so much if it's so good for us?
Well, that's the title of that's basically the subject of my new book. But I study the biology and evolution of physical activity. I'm interested in how and why our bodies are the way they are, and how that evolutionary history is helpful and relevant today for disease and health. And the fact of the matter is that humans evolved to be very physically active, right? We evolved to, you know, hunt and gather and do various sorts of things to get dinner and not be somebody else's dinner. But we never evolved to kind of voluntarily do discretional, unnecessary physical activity for the sake of health and fitness. That's a very modern, recent behavior. And so so the book really is an attempt to try to rethink exercise, because we've, in the current world, we've sort of, you know, made it, you know, exercise is commercialized, it's industrialized, it's medicalized, and that's not really working very well. The vast majority of people don't like to exercise, and they don't get enough. And so the book is an attempt to try to show how an evolutionary and anthropological perspective can help us do a lot better.
So only about a quarter of people exercise, is that right? Like for health and fitness, like voluntarily?
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, the you know, it depends on how you define it, but the pretty much every major health organization on the planet agrees that the minimum level of physical activity somebody should get is about 150 minutes a week. That comes out to 21 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous physical activity. And in the United States, for example, only about 20-25% of people actually get that. And only about half of people ever exercise at all, ever. So, I mean, that's proof in the pudding that the current system that we have isn't working. But everybody knows that exercise is good for them, and just people just don't like to do it, or they don't have the time, or they feel sort of irritated by it or nagged. And, you know, they hate gyms, for example. I mean, I hate gyms too, right? So there's got to be better ways to help people be physically active. And I think that, you know, making it like cod liver oil is clearly not functioning. So we should try something different.
The thought I had, especially with the concept of evolutionary biology, is that there are no, I checked, I did a little brief survey and observational study, and there are no saber-toothed tigers anywhere near me. Like, I don't need to run away from a saber-toothed tiger. How do I lie to myself and pretend that maybe a saber. I'm pretty fat right now, Professor Lieberman. Like, you could save my life. How do I tell myself that there's maybe going to be a saber-toothed tiger? Like, what do I do with this?
Well, look, we evolved to be physically active for two reasons, right? It wasn't, I mean, yeah, occasionally we ran away from saber-toothed tigers or lions or hyenas and things like that. I actually once had to run away from a hyena. But the vast majority of times we were physically active was either when it was necessary, for example, in order to get dinner, right? Or because it was fun. And so I think we should treat exercise a bit like education, make it necessary and fun. Because education, if you think about it, is also a modern thing, right? Nobody ever read until recently, right? Reading is a completely modern behavior. We send our kids to school because we think, you know, reading is like necessary, right? But we've made it necessary. We've also made it fun because school is fun. So let's treat exercise in the kind of the same way, right? Make it necessary and fun. Because, you know, I mean, the cover of the book is a joke, right? It's this you know, kind of rock art painting of, you know, somebody on a treadmill. And I do that because the treadmill is to me like the apotheosis of exercise, right? Right. It's this nasty, horrible machine. We pay money to use it, right? To go work really hard to get nowhere, right? And do absolutely nothing, right? And so the way we tolerate a treadmill is by, you know, listening to a podcast or maybe watching your show or something like that makes it tolerable. But the exercise itself isn't any fun, right? And that's why people hate it. And, you know, so why not go dancing or, you know, go for a walk with a friend, or there's so many ways or play tennis with your last guest's, you know, fancy schmancy, you know, ascot manner. I mean, there's lots of ways to do it that are fun. That's, you know, and also if you do it socially, that's what makes it fun. So let's focus on those methods rather than the current sort of medicalized, commodified way we do it now. It's been, for most people, a failure.
The most fun I ever had doing something fitness related was the Spartan race. And the Spartan race is, I got involved with it because Joe DeSena, the founder, had a book coming out and he wanted me to interview him. And I said, well, I probably ought to run one of your dumb races. And I did. And it was super fun because it's an obstacle kind of race. And the fun in an obstacle race isn't, you know, that you can run some amount of distance. The running is the least tricky part of it. But, like, you know, you're monkey barring and you're climbing, you know, walls and swimming through mud puddles and all that. Is that sort of in the family of things you want people to do? I mean, that's a little elaborate, but sure, is that where you're going?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, but think about it. Whereas there were also other people, right? That's what made it fun. If you did a Spartan race completely on your own with nobody watching, would it have been fun? Probably not, right? It's no. The social experience that makes it fun. And you know, for millions of years, we've been physically active in the social ways. If you go out with a bunch of hunter-gatherers, right? They're gossiping. They go out together. They hunt and they gather together, and they're talking about who's doing what to whom and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. When people farm, they're often farming socially, right? That, you know, that's how we evolved. But doing it in a kind of isolated way. I mean, sometimes it's fun. I like to run sometimes on my own, and it's meditative, etc. And, you know, sometimes I use a treadmill, etc. And that's fine if you like to do that. That's fine. But the problem is that most people don't like to do it, and they avoid it, and they pay a huge price because. Here's an important fact, right? Even 150 minutes a week, so that's 21 minutes a day. That's not a lot of time, right? 21 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous physical activity will reduce your all-cause rate of mortality, right, by about 50%. That's an astonishing benefit from a very small investment. And importantly, it doesn't just affect just how long you live, which is important. It affects not just your lifespan, but also what we call your health span. How long you live in a kind of state of functional capacity where you can enjoy yourself and not be sick, right? That's important. That's worthwhile. And, you know, I think too many people end up in old age feeling that, you know, wishing that they may have maybe done things differently, but you can realize that you can change things at any time in your life. There's never too late to start, and no amount is too little. There's always a benefit.
The sex count, Professor Lieberman?
Sure, absolutely. Sex is physical activity. Yeah.
21 minutes, everybody.
Sure, whatever works. I'm all in favor of it.
What are we going to do with those other 19 minutes? So, listen, Naz has a question. What's your opinion of things like Peloton or That Mirror, which oddly I know what he means, or any of those virtual trainers?
Look, you know, I'm not judgmental. Whatever works, right? If you like Peloton, that's great. Peloton's expensive. Most people can't afford it, right? So if you like Peloton, do it. If you don't, or if you can't afford it, I mean, that's fine. But remember, we're in a world where you know, and the pandemic has exacerbated this. But the haves and the have-nots, you know, is getting more and more extreme. And one of them is in physical activity, and. Right. And it used to be that the only people who could afford not to be physically active were wealthy people, right? The elites. They were the ones who could sit on couches all day and be served by slaves, by servants and stuff like that. Now we live in a world which is reversed. The only people who can afford to be physically active are wealthy people who can afford gym memberships and have time to go, you know, train for Ironman or whatever it is they like to do. Because other folks are, you know, commuting long distances and have multiple jobs and can't afford the gym memberships and those sorts of things. And so we need to figure out ways to help everybody be physically active, because we pay for all of it. We pay for it in terms of not just human kindness and misery and but also in just healthcare dollars. 75% of the time when somebody walks into a doctor's office, it's for a preventable disease. And the vast majority of those preventable diseases, your vulnerability and the intensity of that disease can be reduced enormously by regular physical activity.
Chloe has a question. People talk a lot about movement being more important than exercise these days. Do you think that changing how we talk about exercise can help change behaviors?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the, I agree 100%. I mean, that's part of the point of this book, which is that exercise is this very modern, weird concept of physical activity. What matters is being physically active. That's what we evolved to do. That's what's hardwired. The average hunter-gatherer, right? So we were all hunter-gatherers until 600 generations ago. Everybody on the planet. The average hunter-gatherer walks at least 5 or 6 miles a day. That's the minimum, right? So that means that the average hunter-gatherer walks from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. every year. That's normal. That's what we all evolved to do. And when we don't do that, we pay a price. But you don't have to exercise to do that, right? If you could just, you know, just walk to work instead of commute if you can, or partly walk to work. Just take the stairs instead of the elevator. There's lots and lots of ways you can be physically active without making it exercise. But we also live in a world where we now, because machines do all our labor for us, we have to choose to do physical activity. And that's what we define as exercise. So make it fun, you know, otherwise you're not going to do it.
I need to know about the hyena story, Professor Lieberman.
So when I was a grad student, I was working at a site in Africa. I work in Kenya. Most of my research is in Kenya. I've been working there for a long, long time. And one day I was mapping an exposure, and I wasn't really paying attention, and I should have smelled the hyena, because they're pretty darn smelly. I don't know if you've ever been close to a hyena.
No, it turns out.
Rank smell, unbelievable. You'll never forget it. And I rounded the corner, and there was this, you know, beady, smelly eyes looking at me, and I I dropped my clipboard and I ran as fast as I could. But fortunately, the hyena wasn't really interested in me, so he went the other direction, or she went the other direction. You can't tell males from females, by the way.
I sure can.
Inconvenient at times.
Yeah, no, hyena genitalia is this very special and interesting topic. Because female clitoris actually looks like a penis, fascinating.
Maybe they're just all one gender, one sex.
No, I think we can establish quite securely that there are females and males. But
why didn't you go to Harvard?
You can't tell by looking at them easily.
And they're not as fussy about wearing dresses. It makes it all very different.
Yeah. There are other sex roles and gender roles. I don't think anybody's really distinguished them yet so much in hyenas.
I have a few more questions from the audience. One is, do benefits of exercise increase with duration and intensity, or only to a point?
That's a great question. So dose is frequency, intensity, volume. There's many different factors. And the answer is, there are sort of different costs. There are different benefits to different kinds of dose. And, if you're, the first and most important thing is that if you're not exercising, anything is good, right? So it doesn't matter how intense it is, etc. But if you want to optimize your exercise or do the best you can, it's good to kind of mix it up, you know, some cardio along with some weights. And if you do cardio, occasionally a little bit of high intensity is great. It has all kinds of benefits. But there's no one kind of exercise to do, right? And there's no one optimal dose. There's no one perfect way to exercise. And, it depends on who you are, whether you're male or female or old or young, or you're worried about Alzheimer's, or you're worried about heart disease, or you're worried about osteoporosis. You know, we try to optimize and prescribe a perfect dose. That just doesn't exist, right? So the key thing is to do what you like and then mix it up a bit.
Dora, future guest Dora Alexander, asked the question, what do you think about the Japanese corporate culture of trying to build exercise into the daily routine?
It's great. Actually, in the book, I went to the only company in the world I know that requires its employees to exercise. They get fired otherwise. It's the Bjorn Borg company in Stockholm. Uh-huh. And every single person in the Bjorn Borg company, which is no longer, by the way, associated with Borg anymore. But anyway, everybody is required to exercise. If you don't want to exercise, you leave the company. And I don't think there are many places where you could get away with that. And as far as I know, it's the only company in Sweden that does that. It's kind of interesting. On the one hand, I find it a little bit kind of, authoritarian, I mean, I'm all in favor of exercise, but I'm kind of like, I think it's best for people to want to rather than be forced to. But in the company, everybody who didn't like to exercise basically left, right? They voted with their feet. But a lot of people in the company admit that it makes them better. It helps the company get along because it's very social the way they exercise. They exercise together.
Screw that. Like, I would do it, but not together.
Oh, it's fun. Actually, I went to their sports hour on every Friday at 11 o'clock. And you don't have to do the same thing, right? Everybody is at different levels, and they make it really fun, and they're very encouraging, and they're very supportive. It's a very warm and lovely environment, actually. Anybody would enjoy it, really. And it's kind of fun. So could we get away with it? I'm not sure, but does it have benefits? Absolutely.
So grabbing everybody back for a quick panel because we're getting towards the end of the show, but I did have, I mean, there's so many comments whipping by. I have two quick answers if you can. One is that Carol says that burpees are the bane of her existence, and Dave says that burpees and planks are the worst. Joe DeCina, by the way, he judges people by whether or not they do it, how many burpees they tend to do.
So, yeah, burpees are tough. We did burpees in the Bjorn Borg company, by the way. They had a burpee contest, and I have to say it was my least favorite thing.
There you go.
And I would judge it. I would want to be the person with the clipboard going, come on, you can do better than that.
Five more. And Naz asked the question, is yoga considered exercise?
Absolutely. Why not? Everything's exercise. Climbing the stairs, yoga, whatever. It's all good. Get your heart rate up in some ways. I mean, it's all good.
Vinyasa flow definitely is. My goodness, that's a job and a half. I thought yoga was supposed to be all spiritual and kumbaya, and they're more like, you're getting ready for a marathon. I'm going to grab our commercial real estate professional, Terry Painter, and our brand expert, Alila Longmire from Ascot. Wow, you just got the whole rundown on we've got to do a lot more exercise, but,
I want Terry, to have a sale.
Terry, I got to say something. Oh, yeah, the sale. Ascot Manor has a sale, by the way, for the love of the game. You can get the code VDAY15 to get 15% off. Terry, I was thinking about the fact that gyms are a crappy business. And I was thinking that Dan almost actually validates that gyms are a crappy business. Gyms are like the worst place you'd want to go to do exercise. Did you feel any kind of vindication when you heard that from Professor Lieberman?
Well, the flip side is that obviously a lot of people love working out in gyms. They meet people. It can be a social. For me, I'd rather, exercise privately. I'm kind of like walk to the beach and jog or swim or whatever. And it's more of a meditative experience. But there are people who love going to gyms. Yeah.
Yeah, and whatever works.
I mean, at this point, I'd go anywhere. I just need to get my vaccination.
Yeah.
I'd be excited to go to the gym.
I interviewed Richard Branson for a Success Magazine article, and I said to him, so what kind of exercise do you do anyway? Because he mentioned something about exercise, and he said kiteboarding. And the way he said it was as if everyone kiteboards. Clearly that's, what's everyone's sport.
It's like the most amazing sport, but it's there's a learning curve with that one.
He sponsors the London Marathon, or at least he used to. And 1 year when I ran it, I think he ran it too. So he's a serious athlete.
He takes it very serious, and he's definitely not going to put it down anytime soon. I don't know, Alila, maybe you could get him to throw a few dollars towards some up-and-coming people in the tennis world.
Hey, I'll take it. I'll take it. I know a few who definitely need it.
Terry knows a lot of businesses. I'm just saying. Maybe we can hook this up.
Naz says, I agree with Terry, no gym for me. So
I actually really do miss it. So it took me years to get to like the gym, and then the pandemic happened. I'd been going every day for like 2-3 years, and now I won't even go near it because I'm in the South and no one masks and stuff. So I'm not doing it now, which is depressing. But I'll go back.
Certainly changes a lot of your energy when that happens.
I'll say. But, you know, I can do any other kind of exercise. That's what I'm hearing. So I'll go kiteboard.
There you go. You have to do two prerequisite trainings of kiteboarding before they even let you run around on the board. Like, they weren't going to let me just rent it and run away with it. So
I had to maybe do this. They knew you.
I had to do this training, and I was not very good at it. So it turned out I never went back for the second one. We have a couple more things to do. One is that we have to do our person of the day. It is. I don't know who I'm going to pick for person of the day. This has been a crazy day.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
You know, here I am looking it all over. There's so many people, and I'm going to give it to future guest Dora Alexander. I think she did great. She pitched in. She had a good couple of jokes early on. So you are a person of the day. Dora, that entitles you to a free apple. All you have to do is go down to the store and buy it with your own money. As Carrie points out, you should probably wash it off.
Really good. Like, really get in there.
Kiteboarding involves a lot of time swaying around on the sand. That's what I did. I sat around on the sand with a kite in my hand like an idiot. But, you know, I guess it's a thing.
You went one time, and you're like, I'm no good at this. Forget it.
Well, no, I just, you know, I don't know. There's a whole thing to it. So the last question we ask every single guest on this show is, what goes in your backpack? It could be something physical. It could be something metaphorical. It could be an avocado. Or, Carrie, what's a good physical one you could throw in there?
A book you hate. Because eventually you'll read it and learn something from it.
That's what Whiskey Nate told us one day. And it could be something very, let's see, this is a ripoff, Chris. teacher's pet. And also, what's a good metaphorical one that we could throw in there, Carrie?
Kindness, like Ariel Helvetica said.
Oh, bless her soul, Ariel Helvetica.
No, burlesque really dancer. Was. I'm only laughing because she barely got it out. We were falling apart over the first person's answer, and then she got hers in. But yes, kindness, and also pride. Horacio Garcia Rojas said pride, like in where you come from. I love that one.
So those are some of the answers. I'm going to start with Alila Longmire. What should go in the backpack, Alila?
I'm going with integrity. I'm going with grit, perseverance, and I'm never without a notebook in my bag just in case my phone goes to hell, then I've got my notes, I've got
you're
numbers,
right.
I've got
and phone.
Yeah, exactly.
That was almost one answer. Very good. Integrity, perseverance, and grits, and a notebook.
Yeah.
Perfect. I love it.
And my tennis balls, of course.
Tennis balls, naturally. You need something to give to dogs. So Terry Painter, what goes in your backpack, sir?
You know, for me, it's something that, and I think this could be a metaphor for anything that somebody wants in their life, that they want to draw to them. And it would symbolize, it's actually going to be, in my case, it's going to be a physical object. And what it is I have two Roman coins. One my father found when he was walking along a riverbank in Rome. Another was one that I bought. And what that reminds me is my love of travel. And my favorite place is actually going to Greece, where you can see just all this history. And it's just an adventure from turning one corner to the next. But having that in my backpack reminds me of my love of travel.
I love it. Coins for travel. Professor Dan Lieberman, sir, what goes in your backpack?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I'm traveling, a spare pair of underpants.
Oh, always helpful.
Just one. If you're going away for a couple of weeks.
You never know, right?
Like a hyena. But, you know, one's all you need.
I love that answer. That's a pretty good answer. I can see it always being very useful.
Almost as good as an extra set of teeth.
Mm-hmm. Which I let them know before you were here. I told them about DJ Cummerbund's extra set of teeth. I think it's a great opportunity. One thing about travel that my grandmother always said is that if you're going to go to travel and you're going to go to different places, you have to be tricky. She always believed that you had to be a little bit more tricky than other people. So she had this one trick about how to hide money. And it wasn't where you thought. It wasn't like in the waist belt. It was a secret place.